Thank you to the fun and challenging Best Fiends for sponsoring our podcast. Best Fiends is the binge-worthy mobile puzzle game. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you and enjoy the episode. May 10th, 1941. Carolina Beach, North Carolina. 36-year-old Leela Bryan and her 3-year-old daughter Mary Rachel Bryan leave their home in the family car in order to drive to a nearby store, but never return. After they are reported missing, an extensive search fails to turn up any trace of them or their car, but Leela's family suspects that her husband, E.C. Bryan, might be responsible for the disappearances. Decades later, investigators perform a dig under the concrete foundation of E.C.'s former residence, but fail to turn up anything, so Leela and Mary Rachel remain missing persons. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering an unsolved missing persons case which took place 80 years ago, the 1941 disappearances of Leela and Mary Rachel Bryan. This story was requested by Leela Bryan's great-grandniece, Becca Chavis, who has done extensive research by digging up all the available information about this case, and she has even gone so far as to publish a couple of posts about it on the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I thought now would be an ideal time to put together a podcast episode, because the date of our release, May the 12th, is just 2 days after the official 80-year anniversary of Leela and Mary Rachel's disappearances. While this case generated some publicity when it originally happened, it pretty much languished in obscurity for decades, until one of Leela's nephews pushed law enforcement to reopen the investigation and perform a dig underneath the house where she once lived. Leela's relatives have always had suspicions about her husband, E.C. Bryan, and believe that he could have murdered her and Mary Rachel before burying their bodies under the house's concrete foundation, but the aforementioned dig failed to turn up anything. After all this time, there has never been any conclusive evidence to indicate what happened to Leela and Mary Rachel, though there have been a lot of different theories. I will add a disclaimer that since this case is so old, and there are only a limited amount of official sources available, a lot of the information which has spread over the years is uncorroborated hearsay and rumors, but I will do my best to try and separate fact from fiction on this episode. Given the amount of time that has passed, the chances of solving this case are pretty remote, but Becca and her family still want to keep the story in the spotlight and ensure that Leela and Mary Rachel are not forgotten. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the disappearances of Leela and Mary Rachel Bryan. Our story begins in 1941 in Carolina Beach, North Carolina, a coastal resort community located in New Hanover County near the city of Wilmington, which had a population of between 600 to 700 people during this time period. One of our central figures is 36-year-old Leela Bryan, who currently lives in a small house on Raleigh Avenue, alongside her 42-year-old husband, Edis Clarence Bryan, who goes by the initials EC. The couple are 1 month away from their 10-year wedding anniversary and have a 3-year-old daughter named Mary Rachel, who was named after Leela's mother. Leela was originally born in Bladenboro, located about 70 miles northwest of Carolina Beach, and was one of 12 children in her family. Following her graduation from high school, Leela began nurses training at James Walker Memorial Hospital in Wilmington. While we can't confirm if this is fact or hearsay, the story goes that Leela first met E.C. Bryan when he was brought into the emergency room to treat a gunshot wound to the leg, as he had supposedly been shot by an irate husband. E.C. was employed as a freight manager for the Atlantic Coast Line Railroad, and after they got married, he convinced Leela to give up nursing and helped her obtain an office job with the railroad. However, E.C. reportedly had one prior divorce under his belt, and for this reason, Leela's mother never approved of the marriage and would not allow E.C. into her home. While the exact details are a bit fuzzy, it sounds like Leela was planning to travel to Bladenboro on Sunday, May the 11th, to visit her family for Mother's Day, and while she would take Mary Rachel along with her, E.C. was not invited. However, on the evening of Saturday, May the 10th, one of Leela's brothers, Barry Lewis, who happened to be a deputy for the Bladen County Sheriff's Office, made a trip to the area and stopped by the Bryan residence in Carolina Beach to see his sister sometime between 9 and 10 p.m. When he arrived, Barry noticed that the family car, a black 1935 Ford Model A coupe, was not parked outside. He entered the residence and found E.C. sleeping, but since there was no sign of Leela or Mary Rachel, Barry decided to wake his brother-in-law up and ask where they were. E.C. claimed that at around 9 o'clock, Leela told him she was taking a trip to the Five and Dime store located on the Carolina Beach boardwalk 2 blocks away. She needed to purchase a brassiere and said she might also stop by the grocery store as well. When Mary Rachel asked if she could come along, Leela agreed to take her, and they both left together in the Ford Model A coupe. Since Leela had not returned yet, Barry decided to drive around the beach and the boardwalk to search for his sister, but he could not find her. By the time Barry returned to the cottage, Leela was still not there, so both she and Mary Rachel were officially reported missing to the Carolina Beach Police Department. At the time she left, E.C. said that Leela was wearing a summer print dress with brown and white shoes and no pantyhose, and her hair was wrapped in a green turban. Curiously, several of Leela's rings were found near the kitchen sink, even though her friend said that she rarely left the house without wearing them. When questioned by investigators, E.C. claimed that he had spent the afternoon doing home renovations and building wooden concrete forms while Leela took Mary Rachel to the beach. He said they returned at around 6:30 p.m. and they all had dinner together before his wife and daughter drove to the store a few hours later. E.C. said that he fell asleep right after they left because he was exhausted from working on the concrete forms all day. However, no one from the Five and Dime store or the grocery store recalled seeing Leela or Mary Rachel that night, and the only reported eyewitness sighting was from a gas station attendant on 3rd Street, who was certain he had seen Leela stop by and purchase 13 gallons of gasoline at around 10 p.m. According to E.C., their car only had about a half tank of fuel when Leela left, so she would have needed to fill up if she was planning to make a lengthy trip. After the new Hanover County Sheriff's Office and the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation, aka the SBI, joined the investigation, extensive searches were performed of the area, but they turned up no trace of Leela, Mary Rachel, or their Ford coupe. Barry Lewis even took a leave of absence from the Bladen County Sheriff's Office in order to participate in the search effort for his sister and niece. The case garnered nationwide publicity, and EC offered a $100 reward for information, but even though there were a number of reported sightings of Leela and Mary Rachel in such states like New York and Florida, none of them ever panned out. Of course, every body of water in the area was searched and dragged for the missing vehicle, and at some point during the summer, a fragment of a windshield was discovered in Snow's Cut, a large canal which connected the Cape Fear River and the Intracoastal Waterway and was located about 2 miles north of the Bryan residence. The fragment was found in 18 inches of water, a few feet offshore from a little beach, and it looked like the glass could have originated from a 1935 Ford Model A coupe. It was sent to the SBI lab in Raleigh for analysis, but it's unclear if this produced any results, and no one knows what actually happened to the glass. 6 weeks after the disappearances, the director of the SBI announced that they had good reason to fear that Leela and Mary Rachel were victims of foul play, and requested the assistance of 200 soldiers from Camp Davis to comb a remote swamp area near Wilmington to search for their bodies. They ultimately found nothing, and the SBI never publicly revealed why they believed the bodies might be at this particular location. The investigation reached a standstill, and after being missing for 7 years, Leela and Mary Rachel were both legally declared dead in 1948. However, just 1 year later, in August of 1949, Daniel Webster, a 22-year-old former Wilmington resident serving a 6-year sentence for forgery at Florida State Prison, confessed to being responsible for the disappearances. He claimed the motive for the crime was robbery, and that he stabbed Leela to death before drowning Mary Rachel and burying their bodies. The authorities transported Webster to New Hanover County so he could help them search the alleged burial location, but nothing was found. The biggest issue with Webster's story is that he only would have been 14 years old when the crime originally took place, and he finally admitted that his confession was false. He said that he read about the disappearances in a newspaper article and lied about his involvement because he didn't like how he was being treated at Florida State Prison and hoped this would allow him to be transferred to his home state of North Carolina. In April of 1956, some skeletal remains were discovered in Carolina Beach alongside a road near the Cape Fear River, and it appeared they had been recently unearthed by the drifting sand. On the surface, it appeared that the remains were the skeletons of an adult and a child, leading to speculation that they might have belonged to Leela and Mary Rachel. However, after the remains were examined by the director of anthropology from the University of North Carolina, he determined that they actually belonged to 2 adult females and 1 adult male. Some iron nails were also found at the scene, which had commonly been used in the construction of coffins approximately 75 to 100 years beforehand, so it seemed likely that the location was an old, unmarked burial ground, which the remains have been unearthed from. In 1987, one of Leela's nephews, Lewis Smith, spoke to the son of a man named Carl Ponzer, who shared a surprising story. Ponzer had once lived in Elizabethtown, but on October the 15th, 1942, he was found dead of a fatal gunshot wound inside his workshop at the age of 56. Ponzer had been shot in the neck with his own rifle, and since a can of oil and a cloth were also found at the scene, it seemed like the gun had accidentally gone off while Ponzer was cleaning it. However, at the time Leela and Mary Rachel went missing, Ponzer had been working for the Army Corps of Engineers as the supervisor on a sewer line project in Carolina Beach. The story goes that Ponzer walked up on 2 contract workers who were burying a woman and a young girl whom he believed may have been Leela and Mary Rachel. Now, details are sketchy about whether Ponzer reported this incident to the authorities and what they did with this information, but Ponzer's son always wondered if his father might have been murdered because of what he saw. Whatever the case, Leela's family always had their suspicions that E.C. was responsible for the disappearances of his wife and daughter. E.C. eventually got remarried and moved to Hollywood, Florida, where he passed away in 1976 at the age of 77. In November of 2008, Lewis Smith contacted the North Carolina SBI and convinced them to reopen the investigation. I mentioned earlier that E.C. had been building wooden concrete forms on the day his wife and daughter went missing. Since the residence had been built on stilts, E.C. was apparently planning to close in the underside of the house in order to build a ground floor apartment, including a bathroom. While the following piece of information is hearsay and has never been officially verified, the story goes that E.C. had been waiting for plumbers to stop by and install pipes for the bathroom. However, after Leela and Mary Rachel vanished, E.C. inexplicably decided to pour cement into the concrete forms and place them in the house's enclosure before the plumbers arrived, which made it impossible for them to install the pipes. For this reason, Lewis suspected that the remains of Leela and Mary Rachel were buried underneath a concrete foundation. The house was still standing after all these years, so in January of 2009, the FBI was granted permission by the current owner to perform a search after ground-penetrating radar was used to detect anomalies underneath the floor in three different sections. They proceeded to dig through the concrete, but did not turn up anything, and it was suspected that the anomalies were caused by soil variations. The FBI has now ruled out the house as being a potential burial site, and Lewis Smith announced that he would no longer be performing any further investigation, stating, quote, "I've always wondered, but enough is enough. I did the best I could. I'm through with it," end quote. However, if Leela and Mary Rachel's remains are ever recovered, headstones have been set up for them in the family cemetery so they can both receive proper burials. But for the moment, Leela and Mary Rachel continue to remain missing persons. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, I would like to take a few moments to talk about our sponsor, Best Fiends. A while back, I started looking for a matching puzzle game that could give me a good challenge and something more than the same basic strategy round after round. And thankfully, on this particular quest, the trail did not go cold. In fact, I guess you could say, I came across Best Fiends, the mobile puzzle game that always leaves your brain feeling refreshingly challenged. I mean, putting together each of these podcast episodes by researching cold cases and exploring all possible theories is a big challenge for my brain, but Best Fiends is a lot less stressful and more refreshing and an ideal way to unwind. Best Fiends is way more than those other matching puzzle games where all you do is smash candy over and over again. It can be so much fun that I almost don't want to stop playing to work on the podcast, but even if you play for long periods of time, that's hardly an issue with Best Fiends, since it literally has thousands of fun puzzles to solve. Since it puts out updates all the time, there's always something new to play every day, and the collectible characters just keep coming. I started playing Best Fiends a year and a half ago, and I'm currently edging towards level 1500, and there's still plenty more to go after that. Maybe you're like me and have some doubts about finding a puzzle game with more to offer, but just don't blame me if you can't put it down. So download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Give it a try. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. Well, believe it or not, this is not the first case I've covered on The Trail Went Cold in which the relative of a person who went missing during the 1940s requested that I cover their loved one's disappearance. You might recall that last year, at the request of the victim's granddaughter, I released an episode about the 1945 disappearance of Mary Jane Van Gilder, a case which is still being actively investigated by law enforcement. Like I mentioned in the intro, it was Leela Bryan's great-grandniece, Becca Chavis, who asked that I cover this story, even though she was not even born until several decades after Leela went missing. Obviously, there's no chance that Mary Jane Van Gilder or Leela Bryan are going to be found alive, but their families still want answers about what happened to them. This particular case is extra tragic, because not only did Leela disappear, but her young daughter vanished alongside her. And while the odds are incredibly slim, it's theoretically not impossible that Mary Rachel could still be alive today at the age of 83. Now, even though this case is 80 years old, it is technically still an open investigation, so Becca's attempts to obtain the official case file from the FBI have been unsuccessful. And that might be why certain details about this story are murky and unclear. One of the biggest issues with covering cold cases from so long ago is that the official documentation can sometimes be limited, and since virtually none of the people who personally experienced these events are still alive today, a lot of the information out there is uncorroborated hearsay, which has been passed down through generations. From what Becca tells me, Leela's side of the family have always suspected that E.C. Bryan was somehow responsible for what happened. And that very well could be true, but there's not much in the way of conclusive evidence which points towards guilt or innocence. But before I talk more about the known facts, I have to address one of the most frustrating obstacles to properly researching this case. Quite simply, putting together this episode wound up providing a unique challenge with separating fact from fiction. Okay, so sometime during the 1950s, a writer named Pat Clausen published an extensive article for True Detective magazine titled The Incredible Disappearance. It is definitely the most detailed and extensive source you'll find for this case online, but the problem is that a lot of the information it presents might be complete hogwash. To provide some historical context, True Detective magazine was a very popular publication during this time period, and when it originally launched during the 1920s, it mostly featured mystery fiction, but would also throw in a mixture of non-fiction crime stories. But as time went on, they decided to focus on publishing true crime stories based on real-life events, but if The Incredible Disappearance is any indication, it sounds like they took a lot of creative license and didn't care all that much about sticking to the facts. Even though these stories chronicled real crimes, they were often written in the tone and style of a murder mystery or noir fiction, which meant the details could be heavily sensationalized. The Incredible Disappearance is structured like a short story, as if Leela, Mary Rachel, E.C., and the people involved in this case were all fictional characters exchanging dialogue. Long story short, this article contains a lot of exclusive information which could cause you to look at this case in an entirely different light, but the problem is that this information has never been corroborated by official news sources or anyone from Leela's family. It also has a ton of inaccurate details, such as how Leela's brother Barry is named Tom. As another example, it depicts E.C. answering the doorbell when Barry showed up at the house that night, even though Barry actually walked inside on his own because E.C. was sleeping. So if the author couldn't get basic details like that right, who's to say he couldn't have made up a bunch of other stuff? For instance, the article says that E.C.'s sister Myrtle was visiting the house that night and had dinner with the rest of the family, which I've never seen mentioned by any other source. In fact, E.C. did not even have a sister named Myrtle, as his sisters were named Mary and Mabel. According to the article, Myrtle left the house at 8:30 p.m. when her date arrived to pick her up. If true, this would be a very important detail, since Myrtle could confirm that Leela and Mary Rachel were still alive up until that point. But I double-checked this with Becca, and as far as she knows, no one has ever corroborated that E.C.'s sister was there that night. But the craziest allegation in the article is that Leela visited a drugstore on the day she went missing in order to purchase mercury bichloride, a powerful poison which was once used to treat syphilis. When police checked the drugstore records, they discovered that Leela had forged the signature of a nurse she used to work with in order to make the purchase. The article even states that Leela had left her home for about an hour and a half, and when she returned, she would not tell E.C. where she had been. So the implication seems to be that she went off to secretly obtain mercury bichloride for unknown reasons. This gives off the impression that perhaps Leela was planning an elaborate suicide in which she poisoned herself and Mary Rachel, but once again, this is the only source which has ever mentioned the visit to the drugstore or the mercury bichloride, and this whole section reads like some murder mystery which the author has fabricated for dramatic effect. It's worth mentioning that consuming and being poisoned by mercury bichloride is an incredibly agonizing way to die, and as a former nurse, Leela would have known this. So that seems like a very unlikely method of suicide. What's particularly odd about the article is that there are other sections which do stick to the facts of the case. For instance, it chronicles how the convict from Florida, Daniel Webster, falsely confessed to Leela and Mary Rachel's murders in 1949, and even though they gave him a pseudonym, Jack Vickers, the details provided seem accurate, and can be corroborated by newspaper articles from that time period. But once you combine this with the questionable details about EC's sister, or the purchase of the mercury bichloride, the entire article comes across as a very weird hybrid of fact and pulp fiction. I mean, just imagine if some magazine decided to publish an article about a high-profile missing persons case from today's era, such as the disappearance of Maura Murray, and then just decided to throw in some random fictitious detail, like her purchasing cyanide. If you took this article at face value, you'd probably have a flattering impression of E.C. Bryan and believe he was completely innocent, as there's even one sentence which reads, quote, "By now, the officers were convinced that Ettis Bryan was above suspicion and in no way involved in the mystery, and was cooperating with the authorities to the very best of his ability," end quote. So I'm going to take every piece of information from that article with a huge grain of salt and focus solely on the known facts of this case. But herein lies another problem. How many of the known facts are based on nothing more than hearsay? For instance, the story which has circulated among Leela's family is that she first met E.C. while working as a nurse after he was brought into the hospital with a gunshot wound to the leg from an irate husband. If true, then this would suggest that E.C. was a womanizer and foreshadow potential problems in his marriage to Leela, but we don't have any official sources to corroborate this story. We do know that Leela's side of the family did not like E.C. too much, supposedly because he had gone through a previous divorce, but Becca has been unable to track down any records of EC's first marriage. We don't have any specific stories about EC being an abusive or unfaithful husband towards Leela, or there being serious issues with the marriage during this time period. And even if EC wanted to kill his wife, would he really have been sociopathic enough to murder his 3-year-old daughter as well? Of course, at first glance, when you hear the detail about EC building concrete forms on the same day Leela and Mary Rachel went missing, alarm bells start going off, but this whole situation is not quite as ominous as it sounds. Concrete forms are wooden frames that are constructed for the purpose of holding freshly poured concrete in place when it dries and hardens, and as far as I can tell, EC did not actually pour any concrete on this date. I mean, it's been alleged that EC filled these concrete forms with cement before the plumbers could show up for an appointment to install pipes, which would be incredibly suspicious if true. But again, it sounds like this story is nothing more than hearsay that was shared by Leela's family and has never been confirmed by official sources. Of course, when the house's concrete foundation was dug up in 2009, nothing was found. I've previously done podcast episodes about other cases, such as the disappearance of the Springfield 3, where I've spoken about the potential problems with disposing of bodies in this fashion. If a body is encased in concrete and starts to decay, it creates an air pocket, which can weaken the structural integrity and cause the concrete to collapse. If EC did bury his wife and daughter underneath the house and covered the area with concrete, it doesn't sound like he could have done this on the same night they went missing, so where were their bodies during that time period? And another big unanswered question is, what did he do with the family car? The Ford Model A coupe has never turned up, so if EC was guilty of murder, he would have had to go to the trouble of disposing of it somewhere, which is not quite as easy. Generally, when a person goes missing alongside their vehicle, the most logical explanation is that they accidentally crashed into a body of water and drowned, but I know that all the rivers and waterways in the area were thoroughly searched and turned up nothing. But on the other hand, we technically only have EC's word that Leela drove away in that car, and I can understand some of the misgivings people have with this story, as he claimed that she left to go to a five and dime store to purchase a brassiere at 9 p.m. I mean, I guess that sort of thing is not unusual today, because we have superstores like Walmart, which are open late, but how common was it to go shopping at that time of night back in 1941? Now, apparently, investigators checked this five and dime store, as well as the grocery store Leela said she might stop at, and no one recalled seeing her at either of these places that night. But if investigators had learned that the stores were already closed by 9 o'clock, then this would have raised some major red flags with E.C. Story, and I see no indication that this ever happened. However, the part which sounds particularly unusual is that Leela decided to take Mary Rachel along with her, but would a 3-year-old still be awake like that at 9 p.m? But on the other hand, if this is true, then it provides a potential explanation for why Leela took the car. The 5 and Dime store was only 2 blocks away, and it sounds like she could have walked there in only 5 minutes, but if Mary Rachel wanted to go for a ride, then perhaps this is the reason Leela decided to drive. Yet if E.C. Story is true, and he is completely innocent of any involvement, what could have possibly happened to Leela, Mary Rachel, and the vehicle during this very short trip? I guess Leela could have been the victim of a random carjacking, and both she and her daughter were abducted, but what are the odds of that? The only reported eyewitness sighting that night was from a gas station attendant, who claimed that Leela purchased fuel at around 10 p.m. I guess it's possible that Leela could have stopped there for gas, but the station was located on 3rd Street, which is in the opposite direction of the Carolina Beach Boardwalk, where the 5 and Dime store was located, so would she have taken this detour? For all we know, the attendant could have seen a completely different woman and mistaken her for Leela. One theory that has been pushed forward is that Leela ran away on her own to start a new life somewhere, which is why she took Mary Rachel along, but the theory really doesn't make much sense since she left virtually everything behind, and I'm not even sure how much money she was carrying at the time. And while Leela's family did not like EC that much, it's never been established if Leela herself was unhappy enough to escape her marriage. However, it's interesting how the main reason Leela's mother seemed to dislike EC was because he had previously gotten divorced. If the Lewis family had that type of attitude towards divorce in general, maybe Leela felt she could not turn to them if she left her husband. But if that's the case, where did she go? We know that Leela's brother Barry stopped by the residence to see her a short time after she and Mary Rachel supposedly left. Given that he lived in Bladen County, it's not entirely clear why Barry would have taken a 70-mile drive to Carolina Beach, though it has been reported that he may have been attending a party there that night. In fact, one newspaper article I found described Barry as having a quote-unquote companion when he arrived at the Bryan residence, though it's never mentioned who this person was. It sounds like Leela and Mary Rachel were planning to travel to Bladenboro to visit her family for Mother's Day, so perhaps the main reason Barry stopped by was to offer them a ride there a night early. But I would be interested to know if EC was aware that Barry was going to show up, or if he was taken by complete surprise. If EC was guilty and not expecting Barry at all, that might explain why he was unable to concoct a better cover story than "My wife and child decided to go out to purchase a bra at 9 o'clock at night." The problem is that it's not clear when the last independent eyewitness sighting of Leela or Mary Rachel took place. I'm not sure when anyone else besides EC could confirm having seen them alive, so if he committed murder, I have no idea how much time he would have had to cover the whole thing up. I mean, he was sleeping when Barry arrived, so he obviously didn't appear to be in a panic state of mind. A lot has been made of the fact that Leela's rings were found near the kitchen sink, as she apparently never left the house without them. If you're looking for a mundane explanation for this, it's possible that Leela could have taken her rings off if she was washing the dishes that night and forgot to put them back on. If EC killed Leela and disposed of her body, I'm not sure why he wouldn't have just left the rings on her fingers in order to make the whole thing look less suspicious. Look, I'm not going to firmly declare that EC is guilty or innocent, because there really isn't any conclusive evidence which points in either direction, and the only information I've heard which might make EC look suspicious is uncorroborated hearsay. I know that EC eventually got remarried, but I do not believe this happened until years after the disappearances took place. The actual marriage certificate for EC and his next wife has never been tracked down, but Becca was able to find a divorce record for this woman, and she was married to her previous husband until 1944, and she also made a request to Social Security to change her last name to Brian in 1957. And while EC did relocate to Florida, he was interviewed for a newspaper article about the skeletal remains which were found in 1956, and it stated that he was still living in Carolina Beach at that time. So it's not like he just took off and fled the state immediately after his wife and daughter went missing. The one lead in this case which has never been satisfactorily resolved is the alleged sighting from the engineer, Carl Ponzer, who supposedly came across two people bearing the bodies of a woman and a young girl who may have been Leela and Mary Rachel. Ponzer subsequently died of a gunshot wound, and since I was able to find a newspaper article which reported on Ponzer's death in October of 1942, we do know that this part of the story is true. However, the article states that the sheriff announced that no inquest was necessary, so it sounds like law enforcement believed the whole thing was a tragic accident or possible suicide, and they had no reason to suspect foul play. Indeed, if Ponzer was murdered because he witnessed the bodies being buried, I'm not sure why the responsible parties would wait 17 months before they killed him. When Ponzer's son shared the story about his father having seen the bodies, he stated, quote, "You don't know the pain that has caused my daddy." He was willing to acknowledge that even if his father wasn't murdered, the trauma of witnessing such a thing could have made him suicidal. The first article I found which mentioned the Ponzer story was published in 1991 on the 50-year anniversary of the disappearances. I could not find any media coverage from 1941 which reported on this lead, though I did see one article which corroborated that a large sewer pipeline was being dug in Carolina Beach at that time. It does sound like Ponzer did report the incident to the authorities, but if they checked his story out, I can only assume they did not find anything at the spot where this burial supposedly occurred. If Ponzer was telling the truth, then you have to assume he saw the bodies of Leela and Mary Rachel, because how many other women and young girls went missing together during that time period? But this opens up so many other unanswered questions. The two men bearing the bodies were described as being contract workers, so does that mean Ponzer knew their identities because he worked with them on the sewer line project? If so, were these men investigated? And what motive could they have had to murder Leela and Mary Rachel? It's interesting how Ponzer's son shared this story with Leela's nephew, Lewis Smith, yet Lewis always remained convinced that EC buried the bodies underneath the house. You'd assume this story would clear EC of any involvement unless he hired these men to bury the bodies for him. Once again, Leela was supposedly taking a trip to a store which was only 2 blocks away from her residence, so what could have happened in such a short trip which led to foul play? Like I mentioned earlier, under normal circumstances, I would be inclined to think these disappearances were the result of a tragic accident when Leela drove the car into a body of water. A much darker scenario is that Leela could have intentionally driven into some water in order to drown herself and her daughter, but I see no indication that she was feeling suicidal at that time. When you look at the route Leela would have driven from her residence on Raleigh Avenue to the Carolina Beach Boardwalk, the quickest path to a body of water that doesn't involve taking a detour would have been to drive straight into the Atlantic Ocean, which is right behind the boardwalk. But could she have done this undetected? I find it very unlikely that Leela and Mary Rachel ran away and started a new life. So if their disappearances were not the result of an accident or suicide, then the only other explanation is that they were victims of foul play and the responsible parties got rid of their bodies and the car. The best case scenario is that they drew the line at harming a child and decided to give Mary Rachel away to be raised under a new identity. She was still young enough that she could have forgotten about her birth family and went on to live a long life elsewhere, though I think the chances of that are very remote. Right now, we can only work with the information we have, which involves a lot of speculation, as there are a number of missing pieces to the puzzle which might shed more light on what happened. After 80 years, I'm not sure we'll ever know the full truth about what happened, but even though so much time has passed, it's still worth spreading awareness about this case, because you can never predict if the right person might be listening who has information. And most importantly, we need to ensure that Leela and Mary Rachel are not forgotten. Anyway, another special thanks to Becca Chavis for providing me with all the necessary information for today's episode and keeping the memories of Leela and Mary Rachel alive. If by chance you do happen to have any information about their disappearances, please contact the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation at 919-662-4500. That's 919-662-4500. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about a famous case from Unsolved Mysteries about wanted fugitive Adam Emery, who may have faked his death after he was convicted of murder and has not been seen for nearly 30 years. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Autumn Dew, Emily S., Nisa, John W., Stephanie S., and Lisa G. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, Murder in Alliance.
Hey y'all, my name is Maggie Freeling. I'm a journalist and producer, and I'm the host of Unjust and Unsolved. And I want to tell you about my new podcast, Murder in Alliance. A real-time investigation into a case that is so bonkers, it's hard to wrap your head around.
Everyone in this town seems to have some kind of secret or interest in this victim, whether it be drugs, sex, or both.
I'll be teaming up with Jason Baldwin from the West Memphis 3 and his organization Proclaim Justice to reinvestigate this murder from the ground in Ohio.
If he slit her throat right here, there would be more blood on that
sofa.
We track down witnesses.
You guys have got to understand what's at risk for me here.
And even uncover massive police corruption.
There were two officers that felt like their brotherhood, their staff, that could have been involved.
This is the case of David Thorne and the murder of Yvonne Lane. Find and follow Murder in Alliance wherever you get your podcasts.
I'd also like to mention that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on the weekend of September the 25th and 26th. So fingers crossed that it will happen as planned. If you would like to purchase tickets to either event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount. So to receive 10% off, visit crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, which has a number of interesting posts about today's case. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.